I was talking yesterday about this idea of projecting an idea just out of reach. You know, if anything, this is quite a scary or frightening illusion. It's like reaching towards something. You know, it's how you make a child walk, is you sort of put something just out of reach and they reach for it. And of course, in the history of romantic ideas about art, reaching for something is, of course, also a very romantic fantasy about artists. But what I meant in terms of this is that I turn it into an idea conception. So it's not about the idea of striving for an object that you can see in your head that's just out of reach, and you can see that what's been made is a representation of this object that's out of reach. It's projecting an idea just out of reach, and that's a totally different thing. So if I project an idea just out of reach and then I make something concrete that has some material fact in the world, this is how you get this effect of interesting. Well, I'm like all of the, anyone like with half a brain, you know, that if you say you're not involved in theory, you're involved in another theory that is about not being involved in theory. I mean, there is no escape. You can't do anything about it. So, you know, it's a Wittgenstein sort of problem. There is no way out. If you knew how to evade theory, you would be able to know the edge of theory, and it's impossible. But it doesn't mean it should drive you crazy or make you lose your mind or even think for a minute that you know what you're doing. It's not about that. It's possible that some artists are free of thinking about things, of course, that's perfectly reasonable. But in the back of their mind, they know somewhere along the line that they're slotting in or they're being accommodated within a matrix of theories. The decision even to go to art school or to decide, I am a contemporary artist, usually it has this element of this second mirror phase where you get this new ego that emerges that's a parallel ego to the original one. It's often a moment of reinvention of who you are, which is often a drive for autonomy away from my suburban background or my bourgeois, petty bourgeois upbringing or whatever. And this gets combined often quite at the same time by a rejection of theory while reading theory. So the feeling that, well, my work is not a victim of these things, but I will read something in order to make sure my work does not become a slave to theory. And it's quite interesting. And of course, maybe that is very productive. Maybe that's great. I mean, maybe that is what people should do. And I had this feeling last night when we were talking, and I talked, and then Dietrichson responded. What he really did is he actually just neatly cleared up the loose ends of what I'd been saying and packaged them up in a more closed way that wouldn't stop artists. Like, if I start making these kind of slightly loose but freewheeling claims towards things with certain analogies and certain images, it could be quite destructive because it suggests that there is a way to be, which is quite complicated. But if he then packages it up and ties up all the knots and everything and points out the contradictions and cleans it up, it becomes something that can be understood and then thereby rejected, which will then continue this kind of autonomous artistic persona of this theoretical young artist that we're talking about. And I think that's what Diederik's really good at doing. He's really good at making ideas and theories seem dealable with, as if you can say that I understand and I can package this and put it in the corner and continue. If theory was really urgent in a strange way in relation to art, right, it wouldn't be so easy to digest it. This sounds complicated, but if you're a 25-year-old student in New York, if there was a really complex and urgent relationship between theory and art, it'd be much more difficult to deal with in a strange way. And actually, it's quite smooth. Okay, it's not easy to read Mille Plateaux. I still find it difficult, and I've read it a few times. I've tried to. It's not about easy or difficult. There's this kind of gap in between what is being described by thoughtful theorists and critical language, which isn't actually what's being done. So therefore, it's quite easy to tolerate. I can tolerate extraordinary accusations about art because I do not recognize the art that's being described. I do not recognize it as what's actually going on. So I just think there's a gap for someone to step in one of the natural responses to this has been to start addressing the idea of the documentary, or to actually step aside from the role of the artist and to use the sites of art to show back a record of what is not being recorded, a record of complexity or simpleness or activism or something. But I think this is actually a symptom of the fact that there is an incomplete description of artistic formation, as it were, in the culture. Thank you.
I'm just going to tell the translator something. I'm going to skip to paragraph, the third paragraph on page 12, because I'm boring myself. Starting with, I used to ask people. You okay? I used to ask people, where is the local glitter factory? And no one could ever tell me. Because in fact, very few people know where glitter comes from. Subsequently, I found out that glitter, you know, glittery stuff, was invented on a cattle farm in New Jersey in 1934, where you can still buy it today. At one point, I found out that glitter, kilo for kilo, is a drug-like commodity. You can go to Vienna, buy 2 kilos of glitter for the same price as a tiny vial of glitter in Stockholm. It has a very underexploited commodity status. Part of this has got to do with the fact that very few people could ever tell me if glitter was made by Chinese children or was a byproduct of the arms trade. Maybe glitter was an innocent material made by well-paid artisans. To this day, I've never been to a glitter factory. I can't tell you if people are happy in glitter factories. I don't know whether glitter factories are organized collectively or whether an international glitter board regulates them. So I've used it in my work as a constant. The use of glitter exposes certain production complications, along with an acknowledgement of modernist art history, and a fairly pragmatic task: cleaning the floor with whiskey or vodka mixed with glitter. Once you've done this, you can see where the floor has been cleaned and labor is exposed. The works are a cumulative negative. So if cleaning is a reductive act, then cleaning with glitter while drinking vodka is an additive reduction. At the Pele Tokyo in 2005, I just spread vast quantities of red glitter with no cleaning. But of course, red glitter is red snow. And red snow is what you get in times of revolution. So my work is often about defining the softer, unclear spaces within the social context that are intended to ameliorate conditions. It is diagnostic rather than viral. But there are times still when you need a picture of what has been transposed. Now, another little translator message. Diederik is going to respond, Diederikson, to my text. If I skip too much for the sake of my own comfort and yours, it will ruin his response. So it's tempting, but I've got 2.5 pages, so I'm going to do it. But I'm going to speed up a little bit, okay? Okay. I don't normally talk this way, that's why. I'm increasingly interested in the question of the post-war as a completed historical period in Europe. This is concomitant with an examination of the history of the post-war as an era of realignment within European culture and subsequent neoliberal attacks on the progressive legacy of post-war social structure, within a context of the suppression of the productive aspects of extreme resistance to that liberal post-war social structure. It's a kind of complicated thing. I became very interested in the way that neoliberal people, as it were, first went after industries that were at the interface with people. In Britain, it was the telephone company, was the first one to be privatized, for example. How do we proceed, and what aesthetic traces are left in the culture from this process of strategic privatization embedded in populist strategy? So what I'm trying to do through the work is look at some of these processes, see how they function, how they collapse, and importantly, how they leak into the forms that surround us. But it's not a consistently stable mode of practice. There are such allusions in the work, but very few didactic or transparent references.
there's an end to despair, good to have birthday. Perspective of the nails, moonlight, another curve, good to have birthday. Feedback from a screaming heel, mama's breast bleeds again, good to have birthday. Lick me clean again, suns are rising, oh it's good to have birthday.
We'll be right back.
This is about wanting to be separate but not marginal, a legacy of my Irish heritage. In the book, Literally No Place, Communes, Bars and Green Rooms, I told the true story of a bar in Derry in the north of Ireland, situated in close proximity to a functioning British Army checkpoint. This story had little to do with going out onto the street and banging dustbin lids, or trying to shoot a soldier, or making art about the things we already know. It was about setting up a social checkpoint, opposite an army checkpoint, a place of discourse within confrontation. Sitting in a bar, in a bunker, right underneath an army post. A normal bar on a Friday night with chintzy things hanging on the walls. Nice red wallpaper, old ladies, children, and Guinness sitting up on the bar. From the outside, it's a concrete bunker and an incredible site of resistance. And on the inside, it's a place of the familiar and of difference. A site that refuses to reflect back to the dominant system that which it already knows, but muddies the message, makes it dirty with the chatter of the everyday. Separate but not marginal, an articulation of difference rather than contradiction. A site of exclusion within the context of a desire for autonomy. The picture of a series of relationships where the question is not, am I included in this structure? Does it represent me? Does it fulfill a fantasy of social work within the cultural terrain? Or, but what about them? But it's an implicated space of pleasure and resistance. Thank you.